Good morning. This is Brian Trumbore with your Week in Review for Saturday, May 1st. Before I get into the action on Wall Street and the travails of that ancient country across the way, a few words on the event that is now dominating the airwaves, the oil spill. This week, British Petroleum announced a profit for the first quarter of $5.6 billion. More than double the pace of a year ago, as the company, like the other big oil operators, benefited from rising prices. But none of this matters following the disaster in the Gulf, which it appears BP is responsible for from a legal and cost standpoint. Last Saturday, posting at 2 a.m. Eastern Time from Beirut, 9 a.m. local, I wrote the following, which proved to be quite prescient in terms of the issues that are now manifesting themselves. Initially, even Saturday morning, BP downplayed the spill. By Sunday, the situation was drastically different and, of course, has only gotten worse. I would just add to my original comments that the Obama administration should have known enough to come out in full force on Monday at the very latest, not Thursday. For this, they will pay a price at the polls come November. At least that's my first reading of the situation. And as I go to post, Saturday's New York Times, for one, is harshly critical of the Coast Guard's actions, it having the immediate responsibility for not calling for more assistance from the Department of Defense. But this is what I wrote last Saturday, April 24th. Quote, the Transocean oil rig disaster 50 miles off the Louisiana coast that claimed 11 lives and left four critically injured could have enormous implications for energy policy in the U.S. should a feared major oil spill materialize. Though at last reported appeared this might not be the case. Here, President Obama just took the first steps, albeit tentative ones, towards opening up parts of our coastal waters to oil and gas drilling, against opposition from environmentalists, and then this happens. It also comes as the industry itself has been touting the past few years how during the catastrophic hurricanes of Katrina and Rita, not one barrel of oil was spilled despite severe damage to some rigs, so the industry needs to plow out all the stops to keep the Transocean BP well plugged up. Well, so I wrote that last Saturday, and clearly I was more on the ball than the administration was, and I was writing from Beirut. So what did we see in the week since I wrote that, aside from what we are now all viewing? The first U.S. offshore wind farm was given the green light by the U.S. Interior Department, despite objections from the Kennedy family, as the proposed project is in Nantucket Sound. Greenpeace was ecstatic, as they've been battling to get the approval for over a decade. This is the kind of thing that the BP spill will only improve the odds of. There are at least 11 other U.S. offshore wind projects in the development stage. And it needs to be noted that, according to a report in the Wall Street Journal, Transocean may have failed to install a remote control shutoff switch that has been used in other oil-producing nations as last resort protection against underwater spills, though experts hasten to add the installation of same would not have necessarily meant it would have worked in such a blowout. The U.S. does not require the device as some other nations do. From a political standpoint, it's a true nightmare for the administration. From a human standpoint, it's gut-wrenching. Once again, these good folks are going to need our help. I watched the entirety of the Goldman Sachs Senate hearings, but for about 1 hour, and was continually sickened by it all. Not because Goldman is guilty in the case being highlighted, including other funds aside from Abacus mentioned by the senators, and not because the supposedly sophisticated Senate panel kept confusing the difference between being a market maker and peddling garbage it created, but rather because, as short seller Jim Chanos keeps saying, the real criminality at Goldman Sachs and many of the other investment banks, or the likes of AIG, resides in the balance sheet shenanigans. But no one seems to know which federal agency is responsible for those kinds of investigations. What's so frustrating is that proof of the accounting chicanery would represent the true kind of material omissions of fact that the public could best understand. As it is, the main part of this story is getting lost in a pile of other merd. But what else did we learn on Tuesday? Call this the Goldman Sachs Random Musings edition in no particular order. When it was announced that Goldman Sachs was an advisor to Palm, which was acquired by Hewlett-Packard, on CNBC, Gary Kaminsky said, the senator should have learned that Goldman Sachs served its customers damn well. What does that have to do with fraud in other parts of the firm, Kaminsky? I mean, I like the guy. I was very disappointed to hear this BS. CNBC's Jim Cramer said Goldman wasn't acting like former Merrill Lynch analyst Henry Blodgett, who peddled securities he didn't believe in during the tech bubble. What do you mean, Cramer? Goldman packaged total garbage, knew it to be such, and then aggressively sold it, and I'm not even referring to the funds discussed in the hearing. It wasn't illegal technically, but it should forevermore be. The whole synthetic CDO business, Goldman's excuse is that it was only giving its clients what they wanted. Well, I'd like to have a date with Carmen Electra. The problem, as further illuminated below, wasn't just that the investment banks created artificial product with zero purpose for the real economy, but that this crap ended up in the portfolios of unknowing municipalities and pension funds. CNBC's Larry Kudlow said Wall Street was not really a casino. I have correctly called it just that since day one of this column. It is nothing more than a casino. If you're a trader, there's also nothing wrong with playing in this cesspool. Good luck and tip the good-looking Caesars girls plying you with drinks. But I've also consistently advised that once you know Wall Street is a casino, then you understand that for a longer-term investor, over time the fundamentals win out over the noise, i.e. the key is earnings. But you have to give it time while constantly keeping up on your homework. So sorry, Larry, you couldn't be more wrong. What the hearings best exposed is the need for real regulation and reform, and on a different note, the focus has to be on three issues: raising capital requirements for the biggest institutions, mandating limits on leverage, and transparency in the derivatives market. It's not that difficult. Someone find me a beer coaster. I'll draw it out for you. Editorial, Financial Times. It was not in the end a decisive showdown. While the U.S. Senate's grilling of Goldman Sachs was both lengthy and pitiless, there was no aha moment. The proceedings will not still the debate about whether the bank did anything legally nefarious when it sold complex mortgage-related securities to investors. That remains for the courts to decide. But if the senators failed to land a killer blow, Goldman did not come out well. The bank offered a masterclass in legalistic hair-splitting and obfuscation. Among other things, this involved senior bankers pleading ignorance of a well-known mortgage product. The most toe-curling moment came when Goldman's chief financial officer, David Vinier, was asked if it was appropriate for a banker to refer to investments the company was selling as shitty. Amid derisive laughter, he appeared to say what was wrong was to express such a thought in an email. Mr. Vinier was obliged to clarify that it was the thought, not the medium, that was wrong. Financial Times continues, "The impression given is that Goldman does not get it. To the man on the street, the synthetic CDO business seems like something from a parallel universe. It bears no resemblance to traditional banking. The idea that Goldman and its hedge fund clients made money from this necromancy by selling duff securities to banks that then had to be bailed out is what infuriates the public. Goldman says thank you to the taxpayer for rescuing it. It believes the banking business should be more tightly regulated, but in its public statements at least, it seems blind to the ethical dimension. The CDO case is not the first time it has faced such questions. It was criticized for selling grease derivatives that helped the country massage its public debt figures. It later sold Greek bonds to its own clients. The bank's failure to engage with the how it looks problem could, if not resolved, threaten its franchise. Clients may conclude that it does not really put them first. The bank needs to show it understands these concerns." That was an editorial from the Financial Times. And here are some real-life examples on how Goldman Sachs and other banks became responsible for the collapse of many a local and even national government. Nathaniel Popper, Los Angeles Times. "The doomed deal at the heart of the government's civil fraud suit against Goldman Sachs was designed for sophisticated investors. One of the main buyers of the complex toxic securities issued by the Goldman vehicle, a German bank known as IKB, paid for its share of the deal with money it collected from a number of relatively unsophisticated investors, including King County in Washington State. In 2007, the county bought $100 million of commercial paper, a type of short-term debt, from Rhineland, a special fund created by IKB that in turn snapped up nearly $150 million of these securities created by the Goldman vehicle known as Abacus 2007 AC1. When the huge financial apparatus devised by Goldman went down in flames, taking Rhineland with it, King County was saved from a loss only because IKB had agreed to insure Rhineland's debt. But the local government wasn't so lucky with a similar $50 million purchase it also made in 2007 from another IKB fund, dubbed Rhine Bridge. The county lost $19 million when Rhine Bridge collapsed and an additional $54 million when other similar funds defaulted. About 100 county agencies in the Seattle area, including some that deal with libraries and schools, saw their budgets cut as a result. The county has sued IKB and the rating firms that put their stamps of approval on Rhine Bridge. They invested in commercial paper and they thought it was as safe as treasury bonds, said James Cox, a professor of securities law at Duke University. They undoubtedly thought they were investing in something much more secure. The case illustrates how complicated schemes created by Wall Street toward the end of the mortgage boom depended ultimately on Main Street's money. The relationships were so tangled that some parties have since been labeled both victims and perpetrators. In the Abacus deal, the SEC suit says IKB was misled by Goldman about the nature of the deal. King County's suit, however, claims IKB was smart enough to realize it was buying toxic assets and hid their risk from Rhinebridge's investors. What we define as sophisticated is turning out to be not all that sophisticated after all, said Lynn Stout, a professor of securities law at UCLA. A lot of people, sophisticated and unsophisticated, had come to trust regulators to make sure that investments were honestly marketed. That was Nathaniel Popper, Los Angeles Times. Ah, yes, the marketing of all this crapola. When I was in the fun game, I learned firsthand the importance of a good compliance department. I also had to set the tone for our salespeople. On the ethics front, this is where Goldman and the street in general went horribly bad. So where was the compliance in peddling the Goldman CDO crap? Why, there was none needed because the banks paid off the ratings agencies for that AAA label and everything took care of itself. I know it's AAA, but I'm getting a yield far higher than Treasuries. What's the gig? A client might have asked. Joe, we've known each other a long time. S&P looked this portfolio over about 16 different ways. Worst case, 2, maybe 3% of the mortgages go bad, and that's really a worst case, like Armageddon. That's exactly how some of these sales pitches went. I guarantee it. Another note on this garbage. In Italy alone, similar deals to the one described above found their way into an estimated 519 cities and towns that are facing more than $1.3 billion in losses from derivatives deals, according to a report from the Bank of Italy and the Washington Post. 519 in Italy. Which brings one to Greece. This weekend we'll learn details on how Greece is planning on containing its debt crisis, even as Athens police battle protesters objecting to severe austerity plans that will send the Greek economy into a years-long severe recession, if not outright depression. The EU and IMF are to be activating a three-year rescue package of at least $60 billion to as much as $160 billion, as Greece faces an immediate deadline this month to repay about $12 billion in maturing debts. But as we've been discussing for weeks now, this is indeed, in economist Nouriel Roubini's words, just the tip of the iceberg. As Portugal and Spain saw their credit rating downgraded, while Greece's was reduced to junk status, S&P estimated the Greek bondholders could lose $265 billion if the nation defaults. Certainly, in any restructuring short of that, bondholders will get back maybe 30 to 50 cents on the dollar. The interest rate on a two-year Greek piece of government paper had a yield of 25% at one point this week. To carry it forward to the other trouble spots, though, economists at Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan Chase, and RBS estimated that the Euro nations may need to provide as much as $794 billion to solve the regional crisis. $794 billion. Germany is largely cooperating for now, but their patience is already running thin. Imagine attitudes on the continent as this drags out further. I'm dead serious. If the global economy were to double dip over the next 2 years, forget the whole Euro concept of peace and harmony. You'll have war. And having just come from there, once again it could start in the Balkans, though this time Europe couldn't rely on the U.S. to quell what would start out as a mere firefight. In fact, it looks like I got out of Tirana, Albania in the nick of time. They had massive protests against the government on Friday. Plus, the sovereign debt crisis that PIMCO's Mohamed El Arian correctly posits will just be rolling from one flashpoint to another can easily reach heavily indebted nations such as the U.S., U.K., and Japan. A vicious circle is setting itself up, a giant vortex spinning inexorably downward into the black hole. Then, poof, those of us left will start over with our barter economy. Some of you can then exchange your gold bars for kernels of corn. I'll be holding worthless paper and in turn ask you if I can be your farmhand in return for a spot in the barn to sleep amidst the vampire bats. Well, who wants a beer? Really, how can you possibly be optimistic? And I haven't even begun to bring up the usual hotspots, terror threats, etc. Not one. No, this could be a terror of a different kind. Total anarchy in many parts of the world, all as a result of the economy and the rise of truly ugly figures. We've seen it before. We never learn. But next week I'll lay down all my thoughts on the economy and the markets, including the issue of protectionism. It's been a little hectic the past few days, catching up after my trip, so I'll cover it all next time instead. For now, stocks suffered the worst week since January. For the Dow Jones and NASDAQ, the first losing 1 in 9, as the Dow Jones lost 1.7%, the S&P 500 2.5%, and NASDAQ 2.7%. It was all about Greece and Goldman, with the latter suffering mightily on Friday due to reports the Justice Department is now looking into the firm. Ironically, Industrial American, the firm Caterpillar, Whirlpool, GE, 3M, and DuPont all gave favorable outlooks for the balance of 2010. Earlier than I thought they would, and the first estimate on GDP growth for the first quarter came in at a solid 3.2%, though down from the fourth quarter's 5.6%. On the housing front, the Case-Shiller 20-city index for February was down 0.1% from January, though up 0.6% from a year ago, and a further sign of stability, but little else. The first-time homebuyer credit expired on Friday. Additionally, in another yawner, the Federal Reserve opted to hold the line yet again on interest rates, though it said the labor market is beginning to improve. That's all for this week. I'll be back with you next Saturday, May 8th. Have a great one. Enjoy the Kentucky Derby, and talk to you soon.